Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. As always, we have another very interesting author, and this one I've stolen from the UK before the book is actually released in the United States. Our guest is Ned Palmer, author of A Cheesemonger's History of the British Isles, published by Profile some time ago in Britain, but not to be released in the US until September. So why, I don't know. Ned's cheesemonger career began when he ate a piece of cheese. Now, I'm going to mispronounce many cheeses in this interview. Here's the first one. The cheese he ate was Trethawan's Gorwyd Caerphilly.
It was a pretty good go.
The eponymous Mr. Trethawan was a bit taken aback by the enthusiasm that Ned exhibited over his hankering, as John Cleese would say, of the cheese, that he offered him a job at Neil's Dairy Farm, a place that's close to Ned's heart and apparently to the hearts of many cheesemongers in the British Isles. So notwithstanding Ned's previous predilection for jazz piano, he found himself working jobs from cashier to seller, washing, rubbing, padding, and sometimes singing to his cheeses, as I am wont to do with our chickens and their eggs. And now he's set up and runs the cheese tasting company, talking cheese to the populace, and travels about Britain and Europe, but unfortunately, I think not as yet to the States, visiting the cheesemongers of note and sharing, as we would say, war stories with them. In England, this book has received many honors and was a top 10 bestseller. And I assume that will be true in the United States as well, at least in my shop, Wellington Square Bookshop. So welcome, Ned, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. And thanks for that lovely intro. And yeah, you know, invite me over and I'll come and do a cheese tasting in your bookshop.
That would be great. I'll pay for your car from the airport, but I will not pay for your airfare.
I'll see if the publisher will swing for it. That's a joke.
Well, no, they might because, well, here you go. When I first chose your book, it was impossible to get. So I bought it on Amazon UK, which I think is illegal for booksellers in the US. And I put it on the shelf in my shop, which I think is also illegal. But and then I thought, you know, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe this is a boring book with a boring author. But, and it is a big but, when I saw the words Monty Python on literally the first line, I knew I made a good choice. So even though I know you're sick of it, let's talk a little bit about the 43 varieties of cheese that John Cleese asked for to the less than cunning, but idiotic cheesemonger, Mr. Wensleydale. You must hear about it all the time, and people do it with a good accent.
So it's very sweet because, you know, someone comes into the shop and they do the cheese sketch and you can tell they're blessed and they really feel that they're the first guy to do it. And so, you know, you kind of smile and you listen to the whole bit. It's great. Some of them know the whole lot and that's great. But the funniest thing that's ever happened, and this is new content, I didn't put this in the book. I was working in the shop in Neil's Yard Dairy. And the Monty Python crew used to have an office in the yard next door. Anyway, John Cleese came into the shop, and this is way after they'd left that yard. But if you're a cheesemonger and you're in a cheese shop and John Cleese comes into the shop, it's just the most beautiful thing that can possibly happen. But what was even better is that he was being served by a rather obtuse Spaniard called Roy. Now, you have to have watched Fawlty Towers to get this, but Roy is not a million miles away. He's a very nice man, lovely man, not a million miles away from Manuel. So we kept saying, Roy, tell him you're from Barcelona. But I'm not, but just tell him. And Roy didn't know who he was. So we had to keep running down into the cellar to laugh because it's just gorgeous. And it turns out, John Cleese is a lovely man. They had a lovely chat asking about Spain and he got some cheese. And we were saying, tell him we haven't got any cheese. And he wouldn't. So it was just one of the finest moments of my life.
Okay, I see him hitting him across the head and saying, he's from Barcelona.
And the other thing was John's manager was next to him. And he was looking really nervous because he's thinking any minute someone's going to break into the cheese sketch and John say, bored of it, that'd be awful, you know. This guy's comedy gold.
Yeah, at least you don't have someone playing in the background. And
the bouzouki. Oh, if only we'd thought of it. I tell you what, every cheesemonger should have a bouzouki player, or at least a recording in case John Cleese comes into the shop. I'm going to suggest that to all my...
And I think the bouzouki player was a rather famous bouzouki player, I think, because he wasn't part of Monty Python.
Really? I've always loved Monty Python, and I used to do that sketch before I became a cheesemonger, and I never knew that. So thank you. That's just marvelous.
Well, the other thing is, and this bothered me because with regard to Stinking Bishop, Stinking Bishop came out in 1972. The sketch came out in 1972. So at first I thought, but then I realized he didn't mention Stinking Bishop, but they started using it in the live shows after Monty Python ended. So that confused me for a bit.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole sketch, you know, for a while at the dairy, we wondered, by the way, so the shop I worked at was called Neil's Yard Dairy, and it's slightly cultic. So even though I left 10 years ago, I still say we did this, we did that. And it's called The Dairy, as if there were no other to us. But we thought that it was about us because they had the office in the yard. And when Neil's Yard Dairy started, they didn't really sell cheese. They made yogurt and soft cheese. We didn't really sell cheese, and it was entirely possible that Cleese could have come into the shop, said, I'd like some cheese, and said, well, we don't have any. But the timing doesn't work. Yeah, the sketch came out years before the shop opened.
I love the empty bell jars.
Oh, yeah. It's just genius. They were geniuses, you know.
I was. They were so smart, and he was able to memorize this and speak with a beautiful French accent and French cheese. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Yeah. And the only other one I would mention would be Wallace and Gromit. When they go to the moon, and he says, it's like no cheese I've ever tasted.
and you know that, I mean, I'm sure if you've had a look at the book, that Wallace and Gromit really had an effect on the fortunes of British cheese. Because that Wensleydale, which is a wonderful traditional British cheese, nearly got wiped out by World War II, then was in sort of trouble again in the 80s with a lot of the cheeses, you know. People didn't realise what lovely cheeses we had in Britain. They were suffering a bit. And then Nick Park put it in the film. And apparently he'd never had Wensleydale. He just thought it was a funny sounding word. And now their sales are enormous and global. And if you go to the town of Hawes, where Wensleydale comes from, it's covered in images of Wallace and Gromit because they're so pleased with it. I said, oh, I just love that. Cheese is magic. Oh.
I like the way they forgot the biscuits and Gromit had to go back and...
Yeah, that's wonderful. That is, I wonder, it's interesting to me for, say, Americans or any non-British people to watch that, because to me the humour is so daft, it's so British. I think some of it that you guys would go, what? Why is that funny? What?
A lot of people do say that to me, and a lot of people don't like Fawlty Towers, and I almost want to hate them because it's the best television show that ever, 12 episodes, and the Germans.
Oh, God. That, I mean, it's that don't mention the war thing is deep set in our culture. It's so hard, and it's just awful, so boring for Germans, because when I've got over it now, but I made a great friend at university, a lovely man called George, a German fella, and I just used to mention the war all the time because of Don't Mention the War, and it was meant to be a joke, and he's like, why do you keep talking about the war, Ned? Stop.
Yeah. It's like at the very end, where he goes, however did they win the war?
Yeah, well, one wonders.
Well, the other thing about it, and I don't know how they knew, but like you with philosophy, I was a lawyer, not that I use anything about being a lawyer now, but I had a deposition in Germany, in Wiesbaden, and I'm Jewish, and people would come up to me all the time and apologize.
Really?
Which really doesn't help anything.
Gosh, but, no, it seems tactless. I mean, sorry, but how did they know?
I don't know, you know, because I don't know. My last name is Hankin, which is not a Jewish name. And I think I look more Mediterranean than the stereotypical, you know. We should talk about your book, otherwise.
Oh, yeah, no, but this is fun. I mean, you gotta carry on, you know. I struggle when I'm doing, when I started, so we should talk about my book, we'll in a second, but when I started selling cheese at Neil's Yard Dairy, I'd get so excited, and I love telling stories, and that guy, Todd Trithowen, who makes Gorawith Caerphilly, he makes longboats, you know, like they shot the French River at Cressy in Agincourt. And he was an archaeologist, and I'd be selling some of his cheese. And I'd say, this guy makes longboats, you know, amazing. And I'd go off on that. And eventually, my lovely friend and manager said, Ned, it's really lovely when you tell us stories, but can you sell some more cheese for us?
Yeah.
Anyway, ask me about my book. Go on, let's talk about my book.
I do the same thing. It's like, okay, well, here's a question, and you have to answer it. You can't say, gosh, there's so many of them. What is your favorite cheese?
Okay. Yeah, can I have two answers? So my first answer is the cheese I'm eating right now. And I'm not just being silly. What I mean is, so cheese is seasonal. You get goat's cheeses and soft sheep's cheeses in the summer more. And so in the summer, I'm looking for a lovely, fresh, young goat's cheese. And that's my favorite cheese. In the winter, you want richer food that feels more warming. So in the winter, my favorite cheese is Stilton. I haven't said one, have I? Maybe my favorite cheese is Trithowen's Gorawith Caerphilly, because it is one of my favorite cheeses. It's one of the greatest cheeses in the world. He keeps winning awards for it. And it's the reason I became a cheesemonger. So I have a huge affection for it, you know. And it really, as soon as I ate a piece of that, I realized that all the other cheese I'd ever had before wasn't very good. Well, and everything changed.
The thing about it is that it's so difficult for us here, and now I want to do it so badly, to get the cheeses that you enumerate in the book.
Yeah.
But that would be something if the book, and I think it will become very popular, if then the import, I don't know how that would work, but in any event.
I know. Go on.
I was going to say, if you start, I guess you have to start with the fact that, and it's in your first chapter, is that, and when I was a kid, no one was lactose intolerant, and no one had gluten problems, and no one was allergic to peanuts, and no women had microvalve prolapse and carpal tunnel syndrome, but now everyone has everything.
I know, right, yeah.
But it's true, though, that we couldn't digest lactose. And that's I had no idea. So talk about that and rennet. And
yeah, so that was a fact I found absolutely fascinating. When I started researching the book, firstly, I thought I had to teach myself all of archaeology. I'm very completist, so I tend to go right back to the beginning. And my wife, you know, came to meet me at British Library. She's also a writer. She writes historical novels, and we'll do a big puff for her later. But anyway, and she found me reading this book, and it was the book of sort of the very earliest hominids and when they turn into Homo sapiens. And she's like, Ned, you're like, I don't know, 10,000 years before. Geez, why are you reading that? Well, I've got to know. No, Ned, start with it. So yes, in 7,000 BC, when you find the first evidence for cheese making that we have discovered so far, humans, as far as we know, all adults were lactose intolerant. And so you stopped being able to eat, to digest milk as soon as you were weaned, really, off the breast. And what you need to digest it is an enzyme, a lactase. And that would just leave. So in a sense, all of us milk drinkers, enthusiastic milk drinkers, are mutants and are not natural humans, which is, you know, I know you guys in America are very fond of drinking milk. We don't do that so much here. But so it's curious. But the lovely thing, and for me, the sign of human ingenuity is that in a way, humans made cheese. They figured out how to make milk digestible. So some guy or gal, probably a woman, because the women were the cheesemakers, you know, historically, really, and until the monks started making cheese, someone drank some sour milk and realized that it wasn't making the milk. As the milk sours, what happens is the lactose, the milk sugar, is converted to lactic acid. And at that point, if you're lactose intolerant, you can consume it. So somehow, you know, someone brave soul thought, so I'll look at that clumpy sour milk's going to be, you know, how it goes, if it's really sour, it goes kind of clumpy, doesn't seem very attractive. They drank it. I always imagine them going back to see all their folks and their friends say, hey, you can drink sour milk, They're like, no, don't know why, and having to persuade them. The amazing thing as well, which you probably clocked if you read the book, for me, is that it seems as if lactate, as the ability to digest milk seems to follow cheese making. As cheese making, or as the farming culture moves up from the Fertile Crescent, you know, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, moves up into Europe, so does lactase persistence, the ability to digest milk, as if the gene for that somehow piggybacked on the culture of making milk, you know, which is, I mean, I hope if any sort of paleoanthropologist is probably wincing right now at my description of that, but that's how I understand it.
Well, it's a good story about the shepherd up there, you know, being thirsty and realizing, oh, this is, I don't, it's like a sailor drinking salt water and knowing that it's the wrong thing to drink. But
yeah,
what I guess, why then are so many people come into my store and they're lactose intolerant? What happened that this switched back, you know?
Well, it's so... Gosh, we're coming to the limits of my competence, but as a recovering philosopher, I'm absolutely fine to make some stuff. Well, no, not make some stuff up, to have a guess. I think we are more aware of how foods can affect us. And I, too, used to be somewhat cynical, particularly about gluten intolerance, partly because I know people with Crohn's disease or celiac disease where they get very, very ill and perhaps die if they consume gluten. So when I hear people saying I'm gluten intolerant, I can't really, you know, I think, oh, come on, you know. But I discovered that modern methods of bread making and modern some sort of wheat production increases the gluten. If you make sourdough bread, you break the gluten down such a way it's much more digestible. And if you don't, it becomes much harder for the body to digest. So I wonder if it's analogous with cheese making, that some methods of dairy or that people are drinking a lot of milk and that sensitizing, and our bodies are so complex that there might be other things we're doing in our lifestyle that's making that more apparent. I am really interested in the sort of contemporary thinking about gut health and how we need a lovely complex population of microflora in our stomach to digest and to be healthy. And I wonder if you're eating a weirdly restricted modern diet, if you don't have to eat seasonally, you can eat anything you want all year, you might just stick to the five foods you like, you're not spreading that variety. The reason I love this is because it feels to me connected with how I love raw milk cheese. You know, I love complexity, I love multiculturalism, I love lots of bacteria, I love how our cheese culture was populated by the cheese culture of Europe, and we learned to make cheese from the French and so on. So I find something fascinating about that. That was a bit of a tangent, wasn't it? Did I answer your question?
I have no idea. But that's okay, because I do exactly the same thing, but somehow you end up getting somewhere that's near
Yeah,
well, okay. So I'll just veer away as well, because cool. That made me think of bacteria. When you said bacteria, it made me think, well, there's two different molds in your book. One is essentially a canister, and the other is the bacteria. And when you say this to people in the States, mold, you know, they think of moldy cheese and
and
they don't like the concept. Whereas it's a very important component of what your life is about. So talk about
that. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I distinguish, there are two important families of microorganism in cheese making. There are the bacteria, particularly the lactophilic bacteria that eat that lactose we were talking about and convert it into lactic acid, thus A, making milk digestible. They by souring the milk, they protect it from other bacteria that would make you ill or might just taste horrible. And they separate the moisture from the solid. Cheese making is all about getting rid of moisture. You get rid of the whey and you're left with the curds. then the molds that are of interest to us are usually the ones that grow on the outsides of the cheeses. Like when you look at a Camembert or a Brie, you see that white covering, that is a mold called Penicillin candidum. And those give flavor, they ripen cheese, they soften cheese. When you eat blue cheese, like Stilton or Roquefort or Rogue River Blue, an absolutely wonderful American cheese that won best cheese in the world, one of the years. That blue is a mold called Penicillin Roquefort. It's named after Roquefort, the French cheese, because the French are brilliant at getting names and trademarking them. They're just really good at that, you know. So, and it is true that when you're a cheesemonger and you're trying to sell cheese to people, when I'm doing a cheese tasting and I'm talking to people, you have to find ways to talk about these bacteria and molds to a people, to an populace who have become a bit, can be kind of nervous when they hear, oh, this has got mold in it. And they think, well, I don't eat moldy bread. Why would I eat moldy cheese? You find in food cultures where they have not been so divorced from their traditions, like in France and Italy and Spain, that they're chowing away on the gnarly looking cheeses, the molds and the bacteria. When my friend had a child in Paris, in France, that is, not Texas, in Paris, France, they were like, right, you've got to give him some raw milk cheese now to get his immune system going. And over here, you'd be punished if you gave a child raw milk. People would be horrified. And in France, like, give him some Roquefort. So it's that being divorced from our traditions in a way. And I mean, we'd be dead without bacteria, you know, be dead without molds. Penicillin is, you know, Alexander Fleming discovered that penicillin would kill bacteria. And yes, you do have to kind of find a way to talk to people in a way that you can kind of help them to feel okay about that. And the bacteria, I love lactophilia bacteria with a deep-seated passion, because I wouldn't have written a book and I wouldn't have a lovely job as a cheesemonger if it wasn't for the lovely lactophilia bacteria.
Here's a question I always wonder about is, I really like cottage cheese. And I remember the nursery rhyme, eating her curds and whey.
Yeah.
So very few people in America understand the difference or what each is, curds and whey, which is how it all starts out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's, so what I'll do, I guess, is tell you how to make cheese in a few sentences, because I'm just so succinct, as you've already noticed.
It's going to take longer than a few. It'll be longer than a few sentences. I'm just going to lean back and listen.
Okay, relax, everyone. So you get milk. Milk is full of lactose. You add your starter culture, your bacteria, lactophilic bacteria. The bacteria sours the milk, converting that sugar into acid. That separates the curd, the solid, from the whey. The curd is made of fats and minerals, largely fats, minerals, and proteins. And the whey is the liquid phase of milk with some protein, quite a lot of protein in it, actually. At that point, because it's separating the liquid and solid, you can drain it. And then you would get kind of something like cottage cheese or quark, or we have a soft cheese called Philadelphia, but I think you just have a steak called Philadelphia?
No. Well, we have Philadelphia cheesesteak, but I've been eating Philadelphia cream cheese all my life because I drink bagels and lox. So I have a bagel and lox and cream cheese and olives and a slice of tomato, as you would say. And it's like the best thing in the world.
So that cream cheese, in effect, you could make that own by merely adding the bacteria to the milk. As it separated, you drain it in a little cloth and you'd have a form of cheese. And I sometimes think that was the first cheese. It didn't have any of the other tackle in it. It's just that because that's still very moist, you can't keep it long enough to age it, to mature it, to make something really complex and delicious like cheddar. So you add rennet, which is an enzyme that coagulates milk. And what it does, to be a bit technical, is it makes the protein, the milk protein called casein, knit together. For our audio viewers, I've knitted my fingers together in little, our audio viewers, that's the worst thing I've ever said. But anyway, listeners, you knit the casein proteins together in a matrix, and that holds the solids, the proteins, the fats, and the minerals in that matrix, and the rest of the whey, the liquid, is separated out. Then you can, when you look at that in a bucket, in a simple cheese making, you might just do it in a bucket, you would see a sort of set, almost jelly-like set curd, and you would see the liquid whey kind of as a separate thing to that. And then you just need to drain that whey off using these things that we call molds, or they used to call cheese presses or forms. You drain it off and you're left with the more solid curd, which then you age into cheese. So curd is the solid, whey is the liquid. That's the process.
Yeah, I could ask other questions about cottage cheese, but then I'll move on, because that leads me to fresh cheese like mascarpone. Yeah. So how does cottage cheese go to a fresh cheese? And you make a point of talking many times about how if you're going to eat this cheese, eat it within the first week or 2 weeks, because that's what you have to do. So where do you go from, like, say, cottage cheese to a very fresh cheese?
Well, so I'm going to make a terrible admission here. I don't really know what cottage cheese is. I mean, I eat it and I like it, but what we call cottage cheese here is kind of made up of little lumps. Is that the same in the States? Yeah.
You have Breakstone's small curd and large curd cottage cheese in this red container. And I've been eating it all my life and I love it, especially with pepper. And and it's very, very popular in the States, but no one likes the large curd. I like the large curd, but everyone likes the small curd.
We don't make that distinction. So there's another reason for me to come to America, is to see what that is. But there must be something about how it is set or curdled, you know, with the acidity that makes the curd go into those little separate lumps. The cream cheese for me is like the very first phase of cheese making, the earliest, the freshest cheese that's spreadable. And at that point, then you would do things. You drain off more liquid. You would add more salt, which sucks out moisture, and press. You'd heat curd to make a harder cheese. But that, in a way, what that Philadelphia cream cheese we're talking about is the Ur cheese, the beginning of cheese. And then various stages in the making until you end up with very sophisticated technical cheeses like cheddar. And that's why that kind of cheese is the first cheese in my book. So this cheese slatelet that not only will you not get in America, but you'll never get anywhere, because Mary Holbrook, who made it, is no longer with us. And often when people leave us, so do their cheeses. You should write things down. Shouldn't we teach people how to make it per se? But to me, it is the first. I always imagined slatelet was the cheese that our Neolithic foremothers made in Neolithic Britain when they were building Stonehenge, because A, it's very simple, technically simple to make, and fresh, and you would eat it fast in that condition. And I also see it as the sort of the beginning of the cheese making process. And then you keep on doing more and more technical things to that curd to make different sorts of cheese.
So you mentioned, I'm glad you mentioned Mary, because it seems almost as if in the cheese world, she should be canonized. And you describe her in such a great way, both her humorous attributes and her kind of gruffness as well.
Did I mention the gruffness? I'd forgotten that. She's quite gruff.
And then I love the pyramidal cheese that she makes. I don't even know why it's in that shape, but it looks so beautiful.
So there's a fun story about that. It's her cheese is called Timsborough because her farm was near a village called Timsbury. So it's a sort of similar, you know, the name comes from the name of her village. It's inspired by a French cheese called Valençay, which comes from the center of France, the Loire Valley, which is a major center for making goat's cheese. And this speaks to this fact that in Britain, we almost lost all of our traditional artisanal style cheese making by the 70s, which is why I quote the Monty Python sketch, because the fact is that we didn't have any cheese. We really were running out of cheese. And so people just started making nice cheese. And I love this about humans. I think we want interesting stuff. And if the food's boring, people go and make it. But they had to go to places that had the traditions to refine them. So Mary learned to make cheese with French cheesemakers or borrowed their methods and recipes. So hence Timsborough being that, I'm not saying a copy, inspired by that French cheese. If you look at the photo, the top of the pyramid is flat, as if it has been cut off. In France, they have a story that the reason for that is when the British kicked Napoleon and his French armies out of Egypt, Napoleon used to get upset when he saw pyramidal shaped cheeses with the pointy tops, because it reminded him of his defeat in Egypt. And so his minister Talleyrand demanded that the French cheesemakers lop the tops off their pyramids to make it flat, which is a lovely story. But to make that shape of cheese, you need to pour the curd into a pyramidal shaped mold. And it would be really difficult to balance a really pointy shaped mold on your table. So much easier to have a flat top mold. Nothing to do with Napoleon, sheer practicality. One of the things I found about the book was that plenty of the stories that I may have told in the past as gospel true stories about the history of cheese, I could not find any basis for them. So one of our cheese stories as cheesemongers was that Cheshire cheese is mentioned in the Domesday Book, which is the book. So this chap William came over from France and took our land from us, you know, and gave it to the Norman lords who still rule us in the name of people like George Osborne, that's a French name. And we're cross about that. You know, I consider myself to be a Pict, a sort of ancient Briton, so I'm still cross about that. But so he wanted a list of all the stuff that he'd got so he could tax people. So he got his people to go around all of Britain, writing everything down in the Domesday Book, which is an incredible resource for historians. It lists number of ploughs, how much farming we've got. And we always used to say, yeah, Cheshire's the oldest British cheese because it's in the Domesday Book. And then I got my wife to read the entry on Cheshire because it was too boring. So I got her to read it and made her a cake, you know, well, made her dinner. And she read it and she couldn't find it anywhere. No, I read it too. I really did. We both read it very carefully. Not a single mention of Cheshire in the Domesday Book.
You mentioned reading the Domesday Book and you mentioned, you know, in your sense of humor.
Yeah.
You said something about it, you'd rather do something else than read it. I've tried reading it. It's almost impossible to read it. It's like reading Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, God, yeah. No, I haven't managed to read that either. I only got a few pages through Ulysses, and that's not as hard. I'd like everyone to know that I am a very diligent researcher and I read lots of books for this thing. And I certainly did not read the Domesday Book in its original Norman Latin, not at all. And even so, it is not a thrilling read. You know, it's just lists of ploughs and areas of land. And this was a problem that came up a fair bit for me when I was doing the research, particularly with monastic cheese making. What I really wanted to find was recipes, instructions, something that I could then extrapolate from what kind of cheese they were making. And one of the things I found, you read these, you find this lovely 19th century book, they're always written by some colonel who's just retired from India and has come back to London, and he's got a terrible enthusiasm about monastic treaties. And then you get to the book and it's all in Latin, because he knows that everyone reads Latin, and it's in monastic and medieval Latin, and oh God. And you try and look for words like caseus or forma, which would be the mold, but that's just hopeless. So it was a bit tough doing some of the research. And then the other things, people don't care enough about cheese, you might be surprised to know. Historians, in terms of farming, seem much more interested in the arable farming, which is just a big business, and wool farming, because the wool business in Britain made this country an incredibly economically powerful country in the Middle Ages, and they don't really bother talking about the cheese very much. And I had to dig quite hard to find the evidence, but I found one of the most beautiful moments for me was a really lovely book, a little pamphlet by a man called R.A.L. Smith, and it's about monastic farming and dairying. It's in English. Beautiful, interesting list of the equipment and the amount of cheese and the weights of cheese. I was really able to get quite a clear picture of the kinds of cheese they're making. And the thing is, he wrote it in 1942, I think it's 42 or 43. So the war is raging around him. And at that point, you know, if you were in England, you would be pretty certain you were going to be invaded by the Nazis, and that, you know, it was a terrible conflagration. And he decides to write a book about monastic dairying. And I felt my heart went out to him across the decades, you know, a guy like me sitting there in the British Library with bombs and, you know, and obviously I wasn't being bombed, but I felt an affinity with this guy.
My favorite part of the monastic chapter is the fact that the monks were kind of excited that they could eat cheese on the fast day, but then it was determined that cheese was essentially meat.
Yeah. One thing that really impresses me about the monks is that, and perhaps this is as a philosopher, and you might feel the same as a lawyer, is that they had a lot of ways of reclassifying what was quite clearly meat. Like poultry wasn't meat, porpoises weren't meat, or, you know, really great. And then someone saying cheese, they called it white meats, must have been quite upsetting. But I think they just got around it. I mean, they really were fat. They found some bodies in, sorry, I'm not fat shaming the ancient monks, but they were quite large chaps. In your image of Friar Tuck with Robin Hood, is this round, jolly round man. And they found some bodies, you know, in a medieval grave, the monastic chaps, and they had the marks on their bones of obesity. In a time when you dig up other people and they're very thin. So they did have a lovely, well, not all of them, but the more senior guys in the organization certainly lived a very pleasant life.
It's funny.
Really figured it.
Well, again, jumping around, it's funny, the closest you come to denigrating cheeses or like cheeses is when you talk about, and I think I have some in my refrigerator right now, either Baby Bells or Laughing Cow, and Kraft singles, as they call them in America, which are individually wrapped. And it says, it's being honest, it says it's cheese processed or something like cheese. What is that? What is Baby Bell? And why don't you like it?
Well, no, sorry to spoil your fun, but I do. And it's a terrible admission to make, and I'm probably going to not get any cheese tasting jobs anymore. The reason I love Baby Bell, they're like mini Edam. You know, if you think of an Edam, and an Edam's traditionally quite a big cheese. I'm again gesturing, so I'm gesturing about a foot and a half and about half a foot high. And these ones are like little ones like that, and I would have them in my lunchbox at school, and they're great fun because you open it up. You open the wax and
then you have that little
and you have the wax to play with. And so for me, that memory, I enjoy it. Now, it's not a complex product. It doesn't have all those flavors that I can write whole chapters about. You know, it doesn't have a traditional provenance, but it's kind of fun. But those cheeses, like you talked about the Kraft singles, again, is not really my field because I'm not so interested in that stuff. But I know that you get, as far as I understand, you get cheese that's already been made. Sometimes that is, we at the dairy used to sell some cheese that we considered not good enough for sale over the counter to factories who reprocessed it. They whip it up and they add enzymes to kind of re-ferment it and give it more flavor. And I think emulsifiers to get that funny texture that Kraft has. I know of no single artisanal traditional cheese that has that texture. So it's literally reprocessed or processed. I don't know if you remember the bit in the book, which is a cheesemonger friend of mine was in the British Army. And when they write lists of stuff, they write it the wrong way around. So it says things like tins, baked beans, 3 on the lists of stuff for your pack, you know, and they would get this cheese and it would say cheese processed. And they said it was so horrible, they called it cheese possessed, as in, you know, possessed.
I read it.
Satan. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. Funnily enough, you know, I'm up in this place, Darlington, in the Northeast. That was the Darlington cheesemonger who told me that story.
I like the Baby Bells with dipping them into Grey Poupon or what we call Goulden's mustard, like a dark mustard. But the other thing is that it's just, you know, the Kraft singles remind me of when you get a demonstration of the space-time continuum and they drop a lead ball and it
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love that. That's really great. Cheese and physics. There's a lot of mysticism involved in cheese. And I mean, to me, no coincidence that cheese sounds like chi, the mystical power that you would use in Tai Chi. And I actually also, I'm a keen practitioner of a Chinese martial art like Tai Chi called Sheng Yi. And the reason I am is because one of the guys on the board of Niels Yarderi, a man called Bob Coleman, is a very respected teacher of that martial art. And it was a sort of rite of passage that if Bob let you in, that you went to Bob's class. And I went to Bob's class for about 20 years and studied this Chinese martial art. Randolph, the owner of the Niels Yarderi, one of the people who saved British cheese, grew up in Hong Kong, spoke fluent Cantonese, and was himself a very accomplished practitioner of Tai Chi. So another thing that showed that you had arrived at the dairies was when Randolph, once he knew that I was practicing this martial art, he snuck up behind me and kind of belly barged me with his incredible, powerful chi. He's got a lot of chi, Randolph, bang, he belly barged me. I flew across the room. I was actually talking to a customer and trying to sell them a whole Stilton at the time. And that was part of the whole deal. And much was made of the similarity between chi and cheese.
It's like the one-inch punch.
The one-inch punch. So Bob, he said, yeah, Bruce Lee's rubbish. I've got a no-inch punch. Watch this. And he'd put his fist against your body and pop, and you fly across the room. So I love that you know that. We had a no-inch punch in my martial art.
I know. Well, someone did it to me and I couldn't believe what they had done, but okay. So anyway, going off again, because since you go off, I feel like I'm entitled, right?
Well, totally. Okay. Yeah.
So you do wine pairings. And the interesting thing about the wine pairings is you tend toward white wines.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I suppose one thing that I could say is, to be honest, I'm fundamentally quite a perverse chap. And if everyone says this thing, I want to do the other thing. So that's one reason. Red wine is not as versatile a partner with cheese as white wine. And this seems to surprise a lot of people, and actually more people in the Anglo-Saxon culture, so say you guys and us, go to France and they just have the correct cheese with the wine. Of course, wine, you know. Red wine often has a lot of tannin in it, and the tannin seems to react with the fats in cheese to give bitterness in some cheeses. If you have a very creamy cheese like Camembert and you have a very tannic red wine, quite bitter and a funny texture in the mouth. The very big, bold reds, the Australian Shiraz, the Malbecs, that sort of thing, very strong, and they kind of wipe out the flavor of your more delicate cheeses. White wines, particularly when they're not too acidic and they have some sweetness in them, Alsace, Pinot Blanc, Riesling, but not too sweet, that sweetness is a lovely complement to the acidity and the savory flavor of the cheese. Now, so one of the lovely things about my job is that I have to drink a lot of wine and eat a lot of cheese to pair the wines and cheeses for a tasting. And I would go and see my lovely friend Grant, who's a sommelier, and we would sit there with like 5-6 cheeses and about 20 wines to try and pair them. And we found it, I call that research, and it's tax deductible, by the way. And we would just really struggle to find reds. So for any event we did, we must get some reds. We must, but it was much more difficult. I don't know where that habit of pairing red and only red with cheese comes, except you'll be unsurprised to hear I do have a theory. And I can tell you if you want, or you could ask me another question.
You have to remember this. You keep this in your mind while I go off. I had an Amarone once with a cheese and I couldn't even taste the cheese.
Exactly. Now there's the problem, is when you have a wine that's too strong. I love an Amarone with the right kind of cheese, but it's really got to have some authority. It's a really powerful 2-year-old cheddar, lots of acidity, lots of that umami flavor with Amarone. It could be really lovely, or blue maybe. But if you had that, you know, we were talking about the youngest, freshest cheese, like a sort of form of artisanal Philadelphia, wouldn't work because the Amarone would kill it.
Yeah, exactly. What about champagne?
Now you're talking. Champagne and soft cheese. So another way that I like to think of matching wine, matching any drink and cheese, is the sensation in the mouth feel. So if you have a bite of some soft, creamy cheese like Camembert, or we have an English cheese called Tunworth, the French style cheese, Baron Bigord is a wonderful British brie style. And then you have a mouthful of champagne, it turns into this lovely sparkling mousse in your mouth. Plus, in a really great champagne, you know, you get that toasty, almost freshly baked bread when you open it, you get that boof of that aroma of yeast. And for me, that I get yeasty flavors in some soft cheeses. And so that goes really beautifully together. I do love a bit of champagne and cheese, yeah.
So there's this concept in America goes along with the lactose intolerance thing is that dairy is essentially bad for you. And yeah. I always wondered about that because they'll say anything from the idea that it constipates you or the mold. I wonder where that started. Do people think that in England as well?
Yeah, people do. I mean, one of my issues with this sort of idea that one product is bad for you, if I cut out gluten, I'll be healthy, is nothing is ever one thing. I mean, has anyone lived through life? When is anything ever one single thing? When is there one cause? When is there one effect of something? Everything is complex, and especially our bodies and our whole system. So to say, oh, this one single product is unhealthy, and if you eat it, it would make you ill. It just instinctively feels unlikely. I think there is an issue in that lactose intolerant people, if they drink milk, will get very ill. It's not going to harm them, but it's very unpleasant effects. It's uncomfortable. It's an extremely unpleasant thing to have happen to you. They are often extremely skeptical about eating cheese. When I say it's lactose, you know, come on, you can eat all this cheese, it's all great. They look very skeptical because of the awful effects they have had. But I then wonder if that bleeds into, you know, all dairy products. Cheese was always a food for explorers, for soldiers, people on sailors, you know, they got a cheese ration because it's a concentrated form of nutrition. It's a concentrated form of fats, of minerals, of proteins. It's good for you in that sense. As far as I understand, the bacteria in cheese can be good for your teeth because they compete with the bacteria that cause tooth decay. And then the other thing I would say is, you know, we have a phrase over here, don't you have this, a little bit of what you fancy does you good. So don't eat too much, but having something joyful, I think, is good for you. When I have a piece of Trafalgar scallop with kefir, I get a little moment. I tingle a bit, and my hair's got my neck, and I feel joyful. And that's good for me. I'm sure it is. Also, I noticed if I buy and eat that sort of industrial cheese that comes in a block form, I tend to kind of gorge on it, and I wonder why. And I think it's not satisfying me. The flavor is not as intense and as complex, and it's not satisfying me in the way that a piece of Montgomery's cheddar, one of the great, you know, traditional cheddars, would do. And that was a kind of complicated and heartfelt answer, but I'm fairly sure cheese is good for you in moderation.
Well, the other thing is, throughout the book, it's so clear to me, and I'm a lazy person, is that this is very, very hard work.
Yeah, yeah.
So you really must
be a cheese maker. Yeah, well,
I was just going to say, you have to love it so much, especially if you're trying to reproduce cheeses from 1,000 years ago, like your couple who you met that basically are attempting
yeah.
to do that.
Yeah, so there's a very magical moment. It's at the beginning of the research, and actually very early on in the process, I went to Stonehenge because there was a village near Stonehenge called Durrington Walls where they found a lot of the evidence for very early cheese making in Britain. This is 4,000 BCE, 4,000 years before the Common Era. And there was this couple reenacting being Neolithic farmers, and they're making cheese in a little earthenware pot. And it was just such a magic moment for this to happen. A lovely couple. We had a lovely chat. And it was cold, and so it wouldn't really come. The curd, if you say the curd comes, it means it sets. The curd wouldn't come. And that's something that women cheesemakers would have struggled with for thousands of years. But making Mary's cheese, which is small, each cheese doesn't weigh a lot, was exhausting work. Picking up buckets of milk to pour into things, picking up racks of cheeses, bending over cheeses to turn them. And I'd just be exhausted by the end of a day with Mary. And she was in her 70s, just like a spry, one of her little goats, you know, bounding around. Cheddars weigh 24 kilos, 48 of your American pounds. When they're old and have less moisture, when you make them and they are in a great big metal mold like a huge saucepan, they must weigh double that. And you have to pick this thing up, flip the mold and give it a shake to get that young cheese to slide out. And they have to do that over and over again. And I don't think I've ever successfully done it once with it. I can work fairly hard, but I'm quite lazy too. And I couldn't be a full-time cheesemaker. I love to go and visit. I love to get my hands in a vat and feel the curd changing. And I love to see what they're doing. And every time I go and make cheese for someone, I learn new things. And I feel as if the things I knew before have become uncertainties, but I couldn't do it full time. But being a cheesemonger is pretty hard work too. Early starts, lots of washing, because you've got all these cheeses on racks in the cellars. They all need to be turned. I used to turn 50 of those 48 pound cheddars every couple of days. I used to be able to throw a whole cheddar up a ladder to my friend who'd pop it onto a shelf. So it's pretty gnarly work, and you have to love it. You have to really want to do it. If you wanted to earn money, be saving your presents, you could be a lawyer instead. There'd be less heavy lifting and fewer early starts. the way that we used to, well, on my first day at Neil's Yard Dairy, I walked in, and this is my interview. You know, this, I haven't got the job yet. I'm being interviewed. The first thing is, soon to be new friend Kathy, my boss, said, "Let's try some cheese, Ned." And we tasted about 10 cheeses all in one go, you know. And I thought, this is where she sees if I can say something interesting, you know, if I can talk about what I'm tasting. And because she knows I know nothing. No one, when they're a kid, thinks I'm going to become a cheesemonger. You never hire staff who are like, "Yes, I've been practicing my cheesemongering since I was 6. Doesn't happen. But she wanted to see if I could talk about it and you know, be engaged. Then the next thing, he said, "Oh, look, we've got a bunch of dirty racks in here. Do you mind washing them for me?" And I went in, and it's like Rumpelstiltskin, you know, a stack of 100 foul racks covered in mold. And I thought, this is the deal where I show them that I can do a seemingly menial job, you know, with good grace and do it well. I just knew that was what they were after. And I thought, I want to work here. If that's your criterion for having me, that you need to see that I can have that almost humility, you know, to do this seemingly menial job, then I want to work here. And we always did it. When I got to the point where I was hiring people, I'd say to Bill Oglethorpe, the head affineur, I'd say, "Hey, Bill, save all those racks for a week. I want a nice big stack of racks. We've got a new guy." I like that sort of thing. You know,
it almost seems Buddhist in a way, because you could have had all these different careers, and yet you, I don't mean gave up, but you chose to do this. And now it's almost as if you're a missionary to a certain extent. Because otherwise, I'm not going, "Here's your book. You should probably hold it up too." But otherwise, you know, yeah. Oh, yeah. So
wait a minute.
Oh, okay. And then I guess the American cover will be completely different as well, or will it?
I can't wait to see it. I'd be really interested. I like that. I am not a Buddhist, if you know what I mean.
I do.
I'm more of a, I think naturally by my essence, I'm more of a Taoist, because I feel that Buddhists are kind of more ethereal, and there's a sense that one would transcend this plane to something higher or something different. And I like it down here in the mud, you know, and I like to work, and I like to get my nose into all the corners and find stuff out and I've always preferred the idea of the bodhisattva to the person who transcends. You know, the bodhisattva comes back and wanders around in the dirt, hopefully to help other people. And I would love to see myself as a sort of missionary of cheese. I'd love that. I do feel it's part of our job. When someone comes into a shop and you can tell they've not been in a shop like that before and they look a bit nervous and they don't know what to do, and you say, try some cheese, and you give them some Montgomery's cheddar, and their face glows because they've never had anything like that before in their life. And it's so, every moment, every day, I would have that moment with someone, and that was as fulfilling to me.
It's not that much different than being a bookseller, because you get that same feeling. And the idea is of life is, what is more important than making people happy every day?
Absolutely, nothing. And I totally agree. I mean, I used to work in libraries. I used to work in the London Library, if you've ever heard of it. It was a private subscription library set up by Carl. What an amazing place. And it's not quite the same because we weren't trying to sell people books, but have you read Confessions of a Bookseller?
Yes.
By the lovely Scottish guy. And he really gets it. And he's, you know, this thing, people come into your shop and they say, I read a book on holiday and I'd like to buy it. And you say, okay, what was it called? I don't remember.
Okay, it had a red cup.
They do. I had it on holiday. Was it fiction or non-fiction? Not really sure. People come into the shop, bless them, I'm not laughing at them. They come in, they go, I had this lovely cheese on holiday. Go, great, where were you? I was in France. There's like 365 cheeses in France because de Gaulle said so, you know. And you're like, okay, soft. No, and you're trying to figure it out with them and trying to find. So this is going to sound really weird and it's a bit of a dark analogy, but when I'm working in a shop trying to figure out what cheeses you like, what I do is I give you some cheese. When you come in, I think, gee, he looks like he's quite a kind of solid looking guy, dependable. I'm going to try him with some cheddar first, you know, and you're interested, but I think, oh, maybe he's a bit more adventurous. I'll give him some of that Stilton, you know, and I'm gauging your reaction and trying to figure out, and as I figure it out, I can narrow it down, and then I really start selling the cheese. And it reminds me of World War II naval gunnery before they got radar going really properly. And what you do is you lob a shell at the Bismarck and it misses by a bit, and you lob another shell the other way, and eventually you zero in and then you start dropping the shells on. And I once told this very lovely couple about that. And I said, so you're like the Bismarck and you're like the Scharnhorst. And the thing is, they were quite a large couple. And I just compared them to two gigantic World War II era battleships, and it all went quiet for a bit, and then they laughed like anything. But isn't that a bit like bookselling? You're trying to figure out what people like, and
except for the fact that you also have to ballistically make sure you don't hit your own men.
But I know.
But the other question I just thought of, if you're doing that with six different cheeses, is it like wine where you need to cleanse your palate in between? Otherwise, it seems like the flavors would meld together.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true that you are, in that instance, trying to do that fairly swiftly so that you're not bombarding them, to keep on the metaphor, with too many cheeses. That's true. And it's actually, we don't, in the shop, we didn't have, say, some biscuits or water. You just tried it, tried some more. When I'm doing cheese tastings with people, we might have eight different cheeses and they'll tell a story. You know, it might be, I often do the tasting of the book. So I do some cheeses from the book and do that in temporal order. And I would encourage people to just wait a bit, pause, have a glass of water. Because it's very true, like you can taste cheese consciously. You can taste cheese, you know, with your whole being. You're much more aware of the flavor than when sometimes you just snack on a piece of cheese, you know, and you're not so conscious of it.
It's interesting, you know, it's like, and being a philosopher or having studied philosophy, it's almost as if the human race has begun to become self-evolutionary, because none of this stuff would have existed but for the fact that we did it on our own. And I wonder what's next. And also because, as you were saying about de Gaulle, how can you govern a country that has
did it? Exactly. Yeah.
And now you have, I guess at least metaphorically, a queen that's governing a country that now, since your Renaissance, has how many cheeses are there now?
It's this debatable, and I hear this number 800 bandied about a lot. So there may be 800 cheeses in Britain, But again, as a recovering philosopher, I worry about how you count cheese, because you could count cheddar as one cheese, or you could count Montgomery's, Keene's, Pitchfork, you know, and so on. So I do wonder exactly how many we've got. I'd love to find out. The other problem, which I found out recently, because I wrote another book during lockdown, which is it's called A Cheesemonger's Compendium to the Cheeses of Britain and Ireland. I like a snappy title, right? Cheesemonger's Compendium, and there's a list of cheeses, and about 150 of my favourite cheeses. And as I wait for it to come back from the printers, people keep adding new cheeses to their range. People keep making new cheeses, driving me nuts. I think, oh God, I haven't got that one in. So how do you count them? I don't know. There's a lovely story about French cheese where this guy called Patrick Ranks, who I give a lot of love to in the book, he wrote the book about British cheese. I think it's called The Great British Cheese Book. Another guy who really supported cheese in the 70s and really sort of saved it. He went to France, he goes to a market, there's a lady selling cheese, and she's got, you know, five tiny little buttons of goat's cheese. And he says, what's it called? And she looks at him like as an idiot and goes, goat. She doesn't even know what he means about naming it. What do you mean? It's just the cheese, you know. And then he said, how can you count the cheeses of France if that's the attitude? So yeah, maybe 800.
That's the way I feel when I go to France, is if I go to a restaurant that's like a family restaurant and they ask what wine I want, I just say whatever you drink. And it's just what they make and what they drink every day. And it always seems like this is the best wine I've ever had in my life.
God, I always feel that. I love that feeling. I went to a restaurant in Portugal. My mother moved to Porto a while ago. Went to a restaurant and my Portuguese sucks. And it's a mixture of French and barely remembered Latin and Spanish and shreds of Russian, because my mum used to live in Russia. And he just said, in Portuguese, he said, we've got cod, salt cod, we've got chicken, we've got rabbit, we've got red wine, and we've got white wine. And I was like, I'll have the rabbit and the red, please. And he came out and he put the red on the table in some sort of earthenware thing, like his Roman forefather. And then the next thing he said, and I knew just what he said, this is beautiful, great wine, this one. I loved it. I'll have that. I want to eat like that. Yeah.
The other thing is, in France, getting just a baguette and cheese and walking along an esplanade by the left blank, you know, it's just the whole thing together.
And I guess
that describes the love that, it is the whole gestalt of it, you know. It's not just, I don't know, I can't explain it. I'm trying to think of something else that's like that. Books.
Yeah. I've once heard a phrase, holiday wine. Have you ever heard that?
No.
So I came back from Tenerife, and you might have noticed I get quite enthusiastic about things. So what I discovered about Tenerife is that they make really great cigars, which Churchill used to smoke, really? His favorite. And I like a nice cigar now and again, you know, when I've done something good, like got Sunday Times number one bestseller, or wasn't number one, sorry, not Sunday Times bestseller for my book. And they make some very nice wine, I thought. And I bought some bottles of it back. I thought it was really nice. And I was doing a cheese tasting with a sommelier. And I said, hey, you know, Tenerife and wine, it's great. He said, no, it's not really, Ned. It's just holiday wine. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you having a nice time, weren't you? I said, yeah. He's a nice guy in the vineyard. Yeah. And it's a lovely weather. Yeah. And you were really happy, weren't you? Yeah. And the wine tastes great. Yeah. He said, go home and try it. I tried it. It was all right. I just was just really happy, you know, and so it's marvelous.
That's exactly what I meant.
Yeah, well, it's that.
No, I'm just going to say, what prompted you in the first place? Well, okay, I understand your career and how it started, but then all of a sudden one day you said, you know what? I think I'm going to take a whack at writing this. And your acknowledgments are very good. And I've read them and I've read the notes. But what was it that, like, what was the first thought in your mind?
Well, the first thought would be when I was, say, about six and I started writing my first novel. My father was a historian. House was full of books. My mother was a teacher, an English teacher. House was full of books. Dad wrote books. He actually wrote books about the Loyalists and the American Revolution. And my name, Ned, which I chose myself when I was six, comes from a famous loyalist family, the Seaman, who were Ned's father fought for the British, and after the war was being persecuted, and they had to escape from Connecticut. It's in Connecticut. And it's called something. Yeah, escape from there to Canada. And I loved the book so much, I told my parents I wanted to be called Ned now, and it's always stuck. So I always wanted to write books. I thought then I was going to write a book like Treasure Island or something. I went to university to study philosophy because I was going to save the world. And I thought I would write, I would do it by writing philosophical novels like Sartre, because I wasn't at all arrogant. And I just figured out, they had all the revolutions, they all went wrong. I can figure out how they went wrong, and then I can fix everything, and everything will be fine. So I was going to write the next great historical novel. So I did want to do that. My wife writes historical novels. It was all around me. And I guess I started thinking, yeah, I want to write about the stuff that I love so much. And then I was just idly thinking of it, writing things on the back of cigarette packets, you know, and usually things like cheese, ? And how to, and, you know. And then I was doing a cheese tasting, and a guy came up to me afterwards and he said, you know, you should write a book. And I said, well, I sort of am. And he said, great, I'm an agent. Let's go and have lunch. And wow. That was how I met. Yeah. And that was how I met my agent, David Luxton. And I went to lunch with him. My wife was, she's a very cautious human being. Let's call it caution. You know, she was like, well, we'll check him out. And you're like a puppy. So don't like him too much at first, you know, because he might be, you know, he might be moody. We went to Soho House, nice restaurant, and all the staff first named him. They were, hi, David. And I thought, this guy's nice, you know, if the staff first named him. And all that happened was we laughed and laughed. And he said, listen, if you want to write a picture book, it's not really my thing. And I was like, I didn't understand. I said, well, look, David, I don't really want to write a picture book, you know, a coffee table book. So if you wanted to do that, that's cool, but it wouldn't be for me. And we realized that. And I think I'd like to say, no, we are great friends. And he's a wonderful agent. And he's the way he's shepherded me through the process. I'd ring him up and go, David, you've made a mistake. I'm a blithering idiot. I can't write. I'm suffering the torments of the damned here. You know, what should I? And he'd say, Ned, you are the person to write this book, and you can ring me up whenever you want. And he felt like my corner man. You know, the guy in his going, you know, you've got to keep your left up. You know, it's a bit of a grim metaphor, but that's so. In a sense, the reason I wrote a book because David Luxton came up and said you should write a book.
Isn't it funny how life is like that? You just, it's like the movie Sliding Doors. You just happen to pass someone or meet, or you see a woman and you just.
So much. And the whole thing about me becoming a cheesemonger, it's all to do with Todd Trethewan. And he was my friend. He married a school friend of mine. That's how I met him. And I met him while he was still an archaeologist in the 90s. The first thing we met, we were quite drunk, and he's a sheep farmer originally. And he said, fella, I'm going to cut your hair. And I'm like, well, I don't think so, Todd. Yeah, so I'm going to cut your hair. And he gave me a lovely haircut with the clippers. He's just like a sheep. But yeah. That was chance. Then he walked past Niels Dairy when he was on holiday. He was about to do his PhD. And he walked past, saw this job, thought I'd do that for the summer. By the end of the job, he decided he was going to be a cheesemaker. So he rang up his university and said, I'm not coming, because I'm going to make cheese. And he went to study with a guy called Chris Duckett, who's the last man left alive who knew how to make traditional kefili. Sheer chance, you know. And then I came back to London. I'd been in Australia trying to run a theatre. I thought I'd make a living by running a small political avant-garde theatre company with my then partner, and that was not a good way to make money, I discovered. Yeah. So I came back to London and he said, come and sell cheese with me, see what you think. So I get a sense of fear. I think, what if I hadn't popped back to London? What if Todd hadn't walked past? I wouldn't have found the thing I love more than anything. I never stuck a job longer than 2 years. And if you look, I did quite a few jobs. I seriously misunderestimate the number of jobs that I did, because there were too many. My editor said, you can't put all those in. And I never lasted longer than 2 years until this, which has been 20. In answer to a previous question, I also think I wrote this book to try and figure out why it was cheese for me and not the theatre, which I loved, or music, you know, being a jazz pianist, or I quite liked being a librarian. Wasn't enough food, but I liked it. So, yeah, that sense of chance, I agree. I imagine it's a bit the same as being a bookseller.
Yeah, it is. It's just I've always loved to read. And then I thought, Oh, I have all these books. Maybe I should just take these books and move them to another place. And that's how it started. The funny thing is, when you talked about Sartre, a big change in my life was reading the last three or four pages of Nausea. And it changed my life perhaps for the worse, because I thought, okay, back to essence before existence, existence before essence. And then it's really funny because in the last few months, I've interviewed all these authors who are scientists, and the main structure of their book is finding the seat of human consciousness. And generally, it's almost a mechanical thing, whether it's the neurons or whether it's the hippocampus mediating. The pineal gland and the hippocampus mediating memory to the cerebral cortex. But anyway, I always ask them, and you as a philosopher, I go, it upsets them tremendously. I say, what if it's a solipsistic universe? In which case, I wouldn't be talking to you, or you wouldn't, I don't know which one would be talking to the other. And it always upsets them because their bailiwick is what they're studying. If it was a solipsistic universe, it would be very inconvenient for their forte, because it would mean nothing.
Yes. My wife says with some validity that I don't necessarily believe that other people exist and that you're really just parts of my mind. And it makes me quite successful at selling you cheese. Because if you say, Ned, I don't like blue cheese, I think, well, that person is incorrect. That's just wrong. And I'm just going to help that part of my mind to see the right thing. And I'm an only child. And so I'm just, you know, quite convinced that I am maybe just the only person in the universe. Yeah. Or you are.
When I was about 6 or 7 years old, I believed when I went to sleep that my parents dismantled the universe, because there was no need for it. There was no need for it to exist because I was sleeping. And then in the morning before I woke up, they hurriedly put everything back together.
But my God, do you remember the film that came out before The Matrix called Dark City that was maybe a bit better? And that's that. I love that. Do you know, rather sadly, I used to think when I was about six, I sort of realized, so you only work to get food so you can eat and feed your body so you can work. Because it obviously wasn't religious, it seems. And I thought, what's the point in that? And I had this image that everyone in the world would suddenly realize that at the same moment. And I'd come downstairs and find mum and dad just lying on the floor and the postman lying in the street, because everyone had just realized, well, it's pointless. It's a bit sad. But going back to your point, being a bookmonger and being a cheesemonger, for me personally, gives my life huge meaning that I didn't have to get from saving the world, and I didn't have to get from my complete inability to believe in any other sort of higher power or other sort of entity other than the material world, which I can somehow square with my putative Buddhism. I think you make your own meaning.
Right. If someone is sleeping the universe, I mean, you would not change your behavior. Your behavior is what it is, if you're actually behaving. So you wouldn't change it, even if it was a solipsistic universe. We have to stop this now.
That's my fault, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, it started out as your fault, but it's making my head hurt. And I'm and once again, it's the book. The book is what we're trying to.
Yeah.
So, okay, we've done fresh cheeses. So people aren't going to understand the necessity of washing a cheese or the necessity for salt in a cheese and blooming rind, washed rind.
Yeah.
So you have to talk a little bit about rind. We're talking about mold, but we haven't talked about rind.
Sure. So washed rind cheeses, this is one of my favorite things about cheese making, because when I worked in a cellar, and this is going to answer your question, it's just going to be a little tangential at first. When I worked in the cellar looking after cheese with the wonderful man called Bill Oglethorpe, one of the most amazing things to do was to wash cheeses. You take a young cheese and it's completely white. It has no rind and it's quite firm. I'm trying to think of a texture, a bit like rubbery sort of texture, and it's white. You wash it with salt water and over a week or so, it becomes pink, or 2 weeks, pink, sticky rinded, very aromatic. I mean, it smells of barnyards and feet and things like that. And the texture of the cheese goes soft and creamy and unctuous, a magical transformation. And I loved that. And that was this process, it's called affinage, the process of ripening cheese. It's a French word. And so a person who does that is an affineur. And for me, when I got to learn to be, well, at least to study to be an affineur, I don't know. You know, one wants to have humility, so I wouldn't say I was one, but
no.
That to practice a craft like that and to see a magical transformation of a white, firm cheese into a pink, sticky, aromatic, soft cheese was glorious. So you have your brie or camembert, and it's called a mold-ripened cheese, and it or bloomy-rinded, and it has a white mold rind on it, slightly furry, feels a bit like felt to the touch. And that rind is mold. It is penicillin candidum. And if you're lucky and it's good cheese, it's penicillin candidum, geotrichum, perhaps a little bit of yeast and so on. But largely it's this mold. Wash rind cheeses, and I'm probably going to ruin the business of all the American cheesemongers now. Sorry, everyone. Wash rind cheeses are covered in bacteria. So that orange, pinky orange rind is a bacteria, a lovely bacteria called Brevibacterium linens or B linens to its friends. So one lot of mold, one lot of bacteria. You wash a cheese with salt water because you kill the mold that would grow on it otherwise. You kill the spores of mold using your brine, your salt water, and you make an atmosphere that mold doesn't like. It's not going to come back to it. The B linens loves the salt water and the moisture, and so it comes to live on your cheese and creates that beautiful orange pinky rind. And what you can do is you take your old cheeses from the batch, the previous one, the ones that came 2 weeks ago, you wash them with your cloth, dipping it in your salt water and wash them. And that you're taking the bacteria off that older cheese, and then you wash your new ones with the same cloth and the same water, and you're transferring the bacteria over. You think of a starter, your sourdough culture. You know, you make some dough, you take some dough, put it aside, bring it the next day. It's very much the same. The same process. And so that's the difference. So white, bloomy rinded cheeses are mold ripened like Camembert and Brie. Pinky orange cheeses like the famous Stinking Bishop, or we have cheeses. Let me see. I'm trying to think of American washed rinds. I know
Monster. Monster.
Monster. Monster washed rind, classic, smelly, whiffy cheese. They have Munster in France as well, Alsace cheese. A classic of that kind, yeah, and a Poisse and Livre and so on are all of that sort of style. And you know, as you know, I believe lots of us believe that the monks invented those wash rind cheeses or discovered them. I think they happened naturally, and the monks had a boring diet. And there's this cheese that tastes a bit like meat and is quite whiffy. And so they started developing that process. But the thing about the washing is that I loved it so much, I wanted to wash everything. Yeah, in the cellar, it was so fun. And I was like, Bill, can we wash that one? Can we wash that? Yeah, let's wash the Spenwoods and see what happens. And he said, God, everyone, as soon as you teach them to wash bloody cheese, everyone wants to wash everything. It's because you just
when
get
you talk
excited.
About, when you talk about the bloomy rind, this is the last time I'll do this. All I can think of is Mr. Wensleydale going, it's a bit runny, sir, and maybe too runny for you.
It's runaway.
The cat ate it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so, and you know, the cheese making is magic thing. People thought it was because they didn't do microbiology until Robert Koch invented, or Professor Koch invented microbiology, you know, in the 19th century. So they didn't know that it was bacteria converting sugar to acid. They didn't know that it was mold breaking down cheese. And there was a sense, I think, that it was a magical process, and it was down to God, or down to goddess, or down to a whole bunch of gods and goddesses if your cheese making went wrong, it's because you weren't right with God and you needed to fix yourself up with God again.
What about two cheeses, which one, I guess, would be semi-soft, which is after a kind of washed brine. Say, I know it as Havarti. So what would be akin to Havarti in the British Isles?
Well, the Havarti that I'm thinking of is Danish, and it's not, it's sort of, as far, like, bit thin on the knowledge of. Yeah, right. I think we might mean something different by it, because to me it's a slightly rubbery, you know, like Emmental with the holes. Havarti's got holes and is a kind of slightly rubbery texture. But if you're talking about the cheese that's in between the unctuous, creamy Camembert that's running away and the cheddar that is hard, you have that category of semi-soft cheese, which I always struggle to define and end up defining by all the things it isn't. But the Caerphilly Todd's cheese is semi-soft, and so it has a texture that is crumbly but moist.
What about Fontina then? What about Fontina then?
Yeah, I'd say Fontina is semi-soft and is also a wash rind, as has that pink sticky rind.
Well, then, I guess then what? Yeah, Havarti is slightly different in the United States. There's little tiny gaps, but there's no holes like in what we call Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
But, and it is, I love it. It's a good cheese to put on a sandwich.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's, but it's really interesting, because then if you go to, say, I'm trying to think of the, I'm not a connoisseur, so I'm trying to think of the ones I like Manchego. Manchego, yeah. What would be the corollary of that?
Well, so that's a great example. So Manchego is hard sheep's milk cheese from Spain. In Britain, we have a cheese called Berkswell, which is very similar to Manchego, and it's a similar sort of shape. It's a bit like a flying saucer. Perhaps not with the thinner, like one of those flying saucers doesn't have the wingy bits, like you see often in the skies above Darlington, the more round ones. And that is very much based on the Manchego style and recipe. And again, it's one of those cheeses of the Renaissance where the Fletchers, they wanted to add value to milk because they were raising sheep, not for milk, but for meat and fleeces. And the prices were going, get really low. And so they decided to milk sheep instead and make cheese. I think I've got that right. And it's kind of not copy, very much, very similar in that vein. And then these hard sheep's milk cheeses really fascinate me. So you have Pecorino Romano or Pecorino Sardo.
Parmesan, Reggiano?
Well, Parmesan or Parmigiano is Parmesan, we just call it here, is not sheep, it's cow. But those hard sheep's cheeses are ancient. And, Homer mentions the Cyclops was a cheesemaker.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Blew me away when I read that. And you can see the rest, as you read the description of it in Ulysses, you can kind of tell that he's making hard sheep's milk cheese. So that's a really, really ancient form of cheese. And it's interesting that all around the Mediterranean, you have Manchego, Pecorino, Preby in France, all these similar, or Osserati in the Basque country. And so we have a bunch of hard cheeses in Britain that are inspired by those recipes, but they are not of the ancient tradition. So, we've been making cheddar for hundreds of years, say since the Middle Ages. We've been making Stilton since the 18th century, or Cheshire since, well, not 1066, obviously, because we found that out recently. But these cheeses like Berkswell are not perceived as traditional styles, whereas Manchego is very much the style of the Spanish, been making it forever. I mean, with you guys, obviously, your cheese making tradition starts in the 17th century, and obviously the native people didn't, as far as I know, didn't dairy or make cheese, and it starts there. But I often feel Americans are a bit surprised to realize that you guys have been making cheese for a long time. The first governor of Massachusetts, I've forgotten his name now, but his wife was a cheese, well, they came from dairying stock in East Anglia, and his wife was a cheesemaker or would have run the dairy. So cheese is into intertwined with your history. And it makes me a bit sad sometimes. I get talk to Americans over here and they say, oh, we don't have any good cheese in America. We've only got Kraft singles and cheese whiz. And I go, no, you've got, honest, trust me. You've got, oh my God, some amazing cheese. You know, you've got your Vermont cheddar. It's got a noble tradition of cheese making. And the new ones like Rogue River Blue and Bailey Hazen and all these fantastic cheeses. And I guess it's such a big country that maybe it's difficult. You've got a cheese maker in Vermont and, you know, does he get his cheese to the market in California or, I don't, you know?
No, they can only sell it on the internet as kind of like a subscription thing. There are some nice cheese shops, but very few, maybe five in Philadelphia. And one just went out of business. It was great. It's been there 50 years. But I always thought Odysseus was a little hard on the Cyclops. I mean,
I know, right?
I mean, he didn't have to put out his other eye, and he didn't really harm anybody. He had his sheep and his cheese.
He was just making cheese. I know. I don't think Ulysses is a very nice man, or Odysseus. No. Wait, are they the same guy? Is Odysseus Ulysses?
Yes.
Yeah. Good. Your classics is probably better than mine. It's a bit. It's just kind of a grim story, isn't it? And this is not. This is a total tangent. I'm always fascinated by when you read the real versions of fairy tales. They're brutal. And, you know, not in Little Red Riding Hood. She got eaten.
I know.
You know that didn't end well for her at all.
No, they were indeed Grimm's fairy tales. They were not good endings. And then in America, you know, Disney has Disneyfied them. Yeah, has washed them, as you would say.
There are lots of lovely, lovely fairy tales about cheese, and I managed to dig some out. One of my favourite things is that Maeve, the queen of the fairies in Ireland, and when they talk about fairies, they're not talking about nice little things with wings. You know, you don't want to mess with proper fairies. You get into trouble. And she was killed by a fella with a slingshot, and he waited for her at the pond where she bathed, and he waited every day, and he aimed and he practiced until he could hit, and he hit her dead in her forehead and killed her with a piece of cheese. So it must have been hella cheese, you know.
Yeah, it must have been. It must have been a very hot. Oh yeah, that's the other. We'll end on this note.
Right.
So yes, we talked about the very young cheeses.
Yeah.
But as wine. You also briefly touched on the oldest cheeses. How long can you wait to eat a cheese?
I have some great answers for this. So great cheddar might be ready at 12 months. 18 months is a good age. 2 years, you can get some. I recently had a two-year-old Keens. So Keens is a great cheddar-making family from Somerset. Normally, you have Keens at 1 year. And this two-year-old Keens was a magical experience, much more complex and intense. It can depend on the batch. So sometimes, I reckon what happened was that George Keen or his son Richard now tasted a young batch. And I mean, say a set of cheeses made on the 3rd of June in, you know, 2019. And thought, oh, that, we can age that. You know, this is it's got room in it to be aged. And so they would take that batch and age it on. I've heard of, I once had a five-year-old Coulee. So Coulee is an Irish-Dutch hybrid. It's a Gouda style or Gouda, but made in Ireland. And normally you'd eat it about a year and a half, I think. Very, very sweet, like caramel. And poor old Dickie Villams, the cheesemaker, the Irish government put a stop on a batch of his cheese, and he had to put it in a barn and, you know, put like police tape around it. And he wasn't allowed to do anything with it. And it was cleared. And then it took them 5 years or something to get the paperwork or something. And so he had this five-year-old Coulee, and it was incredible. Just a different thing. And we sold so much of it.
How is it still cuttable?
It's hard. It was hard. Yeah, it would a different Coulee. I'm trying to think of a texture to explain it. It's hard, maybe toffee, but I never know if we mean the same things. But yeah, it was much harder, much tougher to cut. It shrunk. It loses moisture. This is a problem. You lose money because you're losing weight. If you bought the cheese off him, and aged it for X pounds a pound, you know, and then aged it and you lost a pound per cheese, you'd lose that money, which is one reason maybe why people don't.
What do you cut them with?
Well, you could still cut that with a wire. So you start with a cheese like Coulee, you have a knife that's kind of got a hooked blade. And so you draw that through the rind to score it, to cut a line through. And then you just get your wire and pull the wire through. You might
Do you have to mount the cheese to do it, or do you hold it?
We have, in England, we use cheese cutters. And I don't know if you guys use them in the States. And that is a sort of, I don't know how to describe it really. It's a sort of flat object with a wire coming through it. It's on a kind of spring. So you put the whole cheese onto that cutter and then pull the wire through. For much bigger cheeses, you just have a wire that has two handles on the end. You know the kind of wire that the spies kill, that, you know, the secret and crank up the edge.
It comes out of the watch spring.
That's it, that kind of thing. It's like that, bit unnerving. It's got the two handles. And you would score your cheese again all the way around, and then you'd trap one end of the wire under the cheese, bring it up over the top and pull it and pull the whole thing. So that if you've done your job well, it falls into two perfect exact halves and looks lovely. We used to love cutting. I used to love cutting down a full cheddar. I'd take it out the front, cut it, in case any attractive women walking past you might be attracted by that sort of thing. And I discovered after years, it's not something that they find.
You know what's funny about men and attractive women? No matter how old I get, I'm 69, I'll be 70 next year. So when I go to the club to work out or training with my trainer, the only reason I have a trainer is because I don't have any discipline. So I feel as if I would disappoint my trainer if I don't go. So that's the only reason I go, even though I'm paying him. But the thing about it is, no matter how old you get, if there's a nice looking woman there, there's a little tiny part of you that thinks that she's looking at you as if she's interested. Whereas in actuality, you are invisible.
I mean, it's a miracle that the human race has survived and that we've been able to breed. Before cheese, when I played jazz piano, I thought that if I played a C7 sharp 9 augmented 11th chord and then played a whole tone scale over the top of that, that the women would flock to me. And exactly the opposite happened. They would leave the room and go and do something interesting. And it's a miracle that I found a woman who could even tolerate me, let alone, you know, spend any time with me at all. It amuses me what we...
People ask me all the time. My daughter says, I wonder why she is with you. But she doesn't say it in a humorous way. She actually is wondering. And it's not the only person. And then I wonder.
I do a lot of the cooking. I love cooking. And sometimes I've been particularly irritating. I do say, why do you stay with me? She says, you cook really well. Anything else? Not really. No.
You must use too much cheese, though.
Plenty of cheese. A lovely chef friend. If you come to London, we must go to the Anchor and Hope, which is one of the great, we call them gastro pubs. And this was a movement from the 90s of pubs actually serving really well-cooked food that was a mixture of French bistro and traditional British food. And the Anchor and Hope used to take our cheese and you'd go there and they would treat you like a king. And I used to play the piano for my supper there. And I was talking to the chef, Jonathan Jones, and I said, how come chef food is better than my food? Because I'm not bad, you know, I'm all right cook, and I go to you and eat your food and it's just better. And he said, Ned, loads of salt, loads of butter, loads of garlic.
I probably
shouldn't say that. You know, I ruined everyone's chef's career. But
what cheese should you eat with Guinness?
Well, the Gorwith Caerphilly is very nice with Guinness or any stout or porter, but actually Stilton. So the tradition in Britain is to have Stilton with port. Right. I don't really support that. I don't think it's the correct match. I think it's just a historical accident. But for me, one of the two best things you could possibly have with Stilton, or indeed any blue cheese, is Guinness or any really good craft beer, stout or porter. I don't know if you can get this in the States, but in Britain, there's a brewery called the Colonel Brewery. And that's spelled Colonel like the kernel of a nut, not the leader of a regiment, but the kernel of a nut.
I'm writing this down.
A fella called Evan O'Riordan, who trained me as a cheesemonger. And then he went to the States, discovered beer, because you guys used to make vastly better beer than us, before about 2005, whenever it was. But and he makes a beer called the Colonel Brewery's India Export Porter, 7.9% by volume. It's a heartening brew. It's rich and thick, based on a very old recipe, but using American hops for the aromatic in your face nature, and that with blue cheese, absolutely wonderful. And I get some of that Rogue River Blue, and I would find someone in the States who's making a porter or stout, particularly if it had been aged in a whiskey barrel, which I bet you could get over there. Have a barrel aged porter with Rogue River Blue. It's a strong old cheese. It would be quite, we were talking about those Gestalt moments. You would probably see whatever your version of God is.
Well, no, with my experience with mind-altering drugs, I unless it would give me flashbacks, in which case I would never have any of it again.
Do you know that cheese is psychoactive?
No.
Shall I tell you why? I don't know if you know this, but I attempted to leave the world of cheese and become an experimental psychologist, because at one point I thought this is no job for a grown-up, you know, messing around with cheese. I've got to save the world, so I'll go and study psychology. And I left the world of cheese and did a master's in psychology, and then came straight back and did cheese again. Cheese cheddar, when you eat hard cheese and it has crystals in it, you know that, have you had that experience? Parmigiano can have it. It crunches. The crunching is an amino acid, a crystallized amino acid called tyrosine. And it is the precursor for serotonin. You need it. Your brain needs it to produce serotonin. And serotonin makes you happy. So cheese is psychoactive and makes you happy.
Well, there's one reason. That's as good a place to end as any, because we've been talking for an hour and a half. I have other things to do.
I know. This is all you see, what you did is you asked me stuff about cheese. It's your own fault.
That's a horrible thing to say, because it's not true. It's your fault. It's 100% your fault. Why in God's name did I pick out the book A Cheesemonger's History? Why would I even know this? You have to give me some credit. It's not even released.
No.
And I read about it.
You did.
I read about it in the Times Literary Supplement, which is the best periodical I get, because I find out the books that are coming out that wouldn't be available here.
Yeah.
And that's how I pick my interviews.
Wowee. That's so lovely to hear. Well, with my father being a historian, and I was a bit of a disappointment to him, because I did a philosophy degree, and don't you want to do a history? History's good, you know, Ned. But the fact that I got a mention in the TLS was a big thing for me. Just a huge sort of, I felt I'd done something useful.
How long has your father been gone?
He died in 96. I know we came to the perfect ending, and you can just tell me to stop, but I'll tell you why. He went to Russia. And he went to Russia because we were living in Harwich on the east coast of Britain. And one day, a 17th century Russian trading schooner turned up in the port, and they had hit the Gunfleet Sands, big sandbank outside Harwich, and nearly drowned, been towed in by a lifeboat. Dad was a very nice man, so he invited them all back, and we fed and clothed them, and then he helped them fix up the ship. And then he sailed to Russia with them in the ship. And he sailed in October with terrible weather, nearly drowned. old fishermen would come up to me in the pub and say, "Your father's that man that sailed to Russia. Oh, shake your hand, boy." And he came back, learnt Russian, moved to Russia, to St. Petersburg, to help them build the Standard, which was Peter the Great's flagship, the ship that won him the battle against the Swedes and made Russia, it is their national symbol. It is the sort of beginning of their greatness, of their power. And I think because he wanted to heal the wound of the Cold War, and he thought, if we build this ship, if we get young Americans, young Brits to come sailing in Russia with young Russians, we can, you know, fix that schism of the Cold War. And he just really believed that. So when he died, it could have been a lot sadder, because he was doing something quite amazing, and his mates, there's a carving of him on the front, on the poop deck, you know, on the front, not on the bowsprit, but it's a carving of him. And they built his coffin out of the wood they were using build the ship. And he had a Russian Orthodox funeral. He was an atheist. We went to see the priest and we said, can we bury him in here? Can he have a funeral? We thought it'd be nice, you know, for all his mates. And he said, was he Russian Orthodox? And we went, no. We told him about the story of Dad. And the priest said, was he Christian? And we went, yeah. So I lied to a priest, I'm sorry, but I did. But he said he's done a lot for Russia. So we had an Orthodox funeral. And I guess I'm telling you that in a way, because it may not surprise you that I became a cheesemonger. And I sometimes wonder what next, you know, maybe I don't know what else there is to be.
Yes, I was a bit surprised at the outset, but now listening to you for all this time and interrupting you in order to get a word in edgewise, I pretty much understand a great deal about you and also your relationship with your wife.
Okay, I'll stop now.
All right, well, this was, I had loads of fun. And honestly, so I've just decided that not only will I pay for your car from the airport and you can stay at my house, but I would fly you over, but only if you could get a fare that would be available on, say, Ryanair. But I don't think you could get that. I'll pay up to if you bring cheese.
Aha, I thought you were going to say that.
Yeah, if you bring cheese. If it's legal, or just wrap it up so it can't.
I want to smuggle it. I will smuggle a suitcase of cheese in.
If you smuggle a suitcase of cheese in, I will pay you $400, give you a ride from the airport, and give you lodging.
My friend, it's a deal.
All right.
I'll see you next year in Pittsburgh.
I'm not kidding. If your father could go to Russia in a ship and almost drown, you can certainly do this.
Yeah, man. I'll do that.
Okay.
It's a deal.
All right. Thanks, Ned.
Thank you so much for having me. That was great. It was a privilege. And I'll see you next year.
Okay. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.